And welcome to this edition of the Healthy Planet radio program. My name is Bob DiBenedetto, the host for the best hour of your life. The one that's always in front of you, right now. The Healthy Planet focuses on topics that will help to educate you about the deep connection among all life on Earth, and the powerful effects your everyday choices can have on creating a clean, healthy, and compassionate world. Well, here we are, since the last show we did a month ago, or just actually a few weeks ago. Russia has invaded Ukraine. It's a horrible situation with over 2 million refugees. There's a sense of helplessness for us watching from this country and hearing about this tragedy, and yet we feel like we can't do anything about it. We're just watching the devastation get worse and worse every day on TV. At the heart of this problem, of course, is a sick man, Vladimir Putin. And there's, of course, been a great deal of discussion about whether he's actually unhinged. Is he showing psychopathic tendencies? Is he a malignant narcissist like another leader we had in America recently? Obviously, I don't know that. He sits at the end of a 40-foot table when he's at meetings, but he could just be a germaphobe, right? But he's sending his soldiers into a country to do an enormous amount of destruction, not only to the Ukrainian military, but to civilian targets, recently a maternity ward, a children's hospital, and of course, a nuclear plant, bringing a war to a nuclear plant that could bring untold devastation to not just Europe, but Russia. I don't think that's an indication of a stable mind, someone who can order this to happen. And a lot of his soldiers don't even know why they're there. And when they are told, and when they are able to see what's going on, they appear to be as horrified as we are. The point isn't whether he clinically has mental health issues. It's like when you hear news reports about a mass shooter who killed 50 or 100 people. And they say they're exploring whether this was associated with a mental illness. And it's like, well, you know, if you shot 100 people, and you kind of planned it, and you went out there and did it, something is not right. And of course, there's some distinction between being Dr. Evil and having a mental illness. We don't have to go there, but the bottom line is, something is not right in this man's mind. And I listen to all perspectives, and some say, well, you know, we've committed atrocities, and other countries have committed atrocities, and war is war, and blah, blah, blah. And of course, I appreciate the work that others do in uncovering war crimes, regardless of what country is committing them. But for right now, we need to call this what it is. And that is unacceptable, bizarre, dangerous behavior, especially when you're dealing with countries with nuclear weapons. What I'm going to talk about tonight is what is it that's enabling Vladimir Putin to go in and do all the damage that he's been doing? And the answer is, at least partially, revenue that he gets from selling of fossil fuels. Let's go back in history for a few moments. Many of you were alive in the 1970s during the OPEC oil embargo. Basically, the 12 countries that made up OPEC said, we're going to stop selling to the US. Gas prices went up more than quadrupled in a year. And as a result, Americans had a great incentive to move away from purchasing imported oil. We were previously a country of gas-guzzling cars and inefficient buildings, and all of a sudden we needed to change our ways because we were being held hostage to buy expensive oil from countries that didn't like us very much. There were long gas lines, there was gas rationing, you could only get gas on even or odd days, and eventually it caused changes. Fuel efficiency standards for cars were put into place, and eventually a 55-mile-per-hour speed limit was implemented on U.S. highways in order to save fuel. We even had daylight savings time year-round in 1974 and 1975. A strategic petroleum reserve was created. I remember back then, most of our cars got in the teens in gas mileage. And then I remember we got a Datsun after the gas crisis, and it got, I think, 45 miles per gallon. It was unheard of back then. But it was doable. People understood that things had to change. And this was before climate change was being experienced in the world and before it was a household phrase. Many people understood that fossil fuels were a source of death and sickness. It's pretty apparent. Breathing in that stuff kills you. But most didn't understand that we were in the process of altering our climate in a way that would potentially change our society forever. And moving forward from the oil crisis, here we are today, in another situation where we are in fact being held hostage because of the money that we're willing to spend on dirty fossil fuels. In all of those decades, we didn't get our act together enough to really make an impact to the point where the world is not dependent upon people in the Middle East and Russia, not to mention all the drilling that's taking place in America and other countries. We had time, we had warning. And many of us have been talking about this for literally decades. We've got to get off the fossil fuels, and here we are again. Vice Chancellor Robert Habeck, who is also Germany's economy and climate minister, said Monday that greater emphasis on energy independence could help efforts to reduce emissions of planet-heating greenhouse gases released by burning fossil fuels. He went on to say, "The only forms of energy that don't belong to anyone, where nobody can say it's all mine and I'm going to blackmail you with, are wind and solar. What we were discussing half a year ago in terms of reducing carbon dioxide emissions, we're now discussing in terms of energy security and sovereignty," said Habeck. In a recent special session of Parliament, Germany's finance minister said the government would place greater emphasis on energy security in the coming years in light of the war in Ukraine. Christian Lindner, German's finance minister, said, "Renewable energy releases us from dependence. That's why renewable energy is freedom energy." End quote. Now, I can't tell you how many pundits and politicians are saying, "Well, this is the time for us to go full hog on drilling for more oil and putting in nuclear power plants that, of course, take 7 years to build and are more expensive than everything else, and, of course, leave waste for our society to handle tens of thousands of years from now. But yeah, we need to put more into nuclear and drill, drill, drill more because Biden has destroyed the oil economy." I looked at charts of the oil and gas production in the United States, and we are near record highs, record high levels of oil and gas production. We need to stop this. We need to get off that train of pushing for more and more fossil fuels. It's as if these people are in the 1950s, as if they haven't seen that there's new technology around that not only has the potential to save tens to hundreds of thousands of American lives every year and millions worldwide, but it has the potential to put many more people to work. And it also has the potential to make every household and business much more efficient, which means you're not spending a lot of money throwing it out the window trying to warm your house or power your equipment. And finally, clean energy is cheaper than the fossil fuels. It's a win-win situation on every level. But they still think the only American thing is oil. American? Something that kills that many people is American? Now, listening to their arguments, if I was just a normal Joe and I had no experience or knowledge about these issues, I'd say, they're making good points. Maybe this is the time to ramp up oil. But the only reason why people are believing that dated perspective is because they haven't heard the other side of the story. And what we're going to focus on is the other side of the story. And that is the urgent need to get off of fossil fuels and ramp up the clean technologies that exist already and are cheaper and will put a lot of people to work. The need to do that immediately, if not sooner. And the way to do that at this point in history is to get everything, including our cars, our home heating and cooling, to run on electricity. Concurrently, you work on making the grid ultra green, and that is with wind and solar. And of course, household solar works into this equation as well, beautifully. I have a home that is entirely run on solar and geothermal, so I don't use heating oil, I don't use natural gas, I don't use electricity from the grid. And that's a possibility for all homes. But For those people who aren't going to do it on an individual basis, your house is covered with trees and you don't have the sunlight, or you're renting, or but that's another story. You can get community solar as well when you're renting. But let's say you are not in a position to put solar on your house or run your house on geothermal, then the point is to make everything electric and for the powers that be to provide sustainable, renewable electricity on our grid. So we need to jumpstart the process of getting off of Russian gas and oil. And we need to start with the worst of the inefficient boilers. And they're doing this in Germany now. The worst of the inefficient equipment has to be taken offline and replaced. Bill McKibben of 350.org said that we should use the Defense Production Act to create heat pumps. Because each house that uses a heat pump removes the demands for fossil fuels coming from who knows where. He's saying that we could create these and ship them to Germany or where they're needed, and therefore address the problem head on. Well-insulated homes running heat pumps for heating and cooling with electricity powered by solar panels when possible, or by wind and solar from the grid. I think the technical term for that is easy peasy. And while this is the best way to move forward, being able to address not only what's going on in Russia and with countries that don't like us getting a lot of our dollars and other foreign currencies, it's also a way of addressing climate change. But the oil companies are now somewhat elated that they can push back and say that there's a dire need for moving toward fossil fuels. Because they've been on the defensive. They know about climate change. In fact, they've hidden climate change from us. One more point before I get to some information on the new Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report. As I mentioned, many of us feel really helpless seeing what's happening in Ukraine. And then, of course, we think there's so much suffering there, but we can't risk a global nuclear war. And we're having difficulty handling it. There's something I haven't heard enough of. While the Ukrainians are losing their homes and their loved ones, fleeing their country in frigid cold conditions, huddling in tunnels and under bridges with their children and animals, how about asking Americans to start taking action on their own? How about calling on the world to make a small effort toward reducing their consumption of fossil fuels? The impact could be immediate and it could be enormous. How about we call that the cost of defending freedom? Instead of just us having to pay higher prices at the gas pump. And to do that, we wouldn't even need to leave our homes. We can turn the heat down in our homes. Everybody in the United States could do that a few degrees. We could put a sweater on. Look, the people back then in America, we had to stand on those long gas lines, and so we were willing to do whatever we had to. How about now? Even though we're not the ones totally suffering from this, how about if we take action now? How about if instead of going to the drugstore one day and the post office the next day and the grocery store the next day, we save it all to one day and we go to the grocery store and the drugstore and the post office all together? Governments around the world could ask their citizens to pitch in to this global effort. What Russia is doing with its military has been called petro-thuggery. That's thuggery funded by petro-oil. We're in a position to stop it, both with our planning and with what we're doing right now, with our homes and our cars. Now, some of you might rightfully think that, well, we've already stopped our gas and oil imports from Russia. However, there's another issue here, and that's that the prices are going sky high for gas and oil. So even if we reduce our consumption and bring down the price in the near term, that also is taking profits from Russia. And that is taking profits from funding the war that they've waged. So that's some of what I've been thinking about relating to the current crisis that we're facing in Ukraine. It's also important to note, and this is something that should have been on TV, on all the stations, on the radio, over the past few weeks, because the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, came out with its 2022 report. These reports, as you will hear, are the results of many years of research by thousands of scientists who produced 34,000 studies. It's the definitive report on climate change that comes out once every 6 or 7 years. So for the rest of the show, I'm going to do two things. I'll play some segments from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's press conference, with scientists from various agencies and organizations across the world, speaking about the startling findings of this latest report. But before we hear that press conference, I'm going to read an article from The Guardian, which I think sums it up very nicely. It's entitled, "This Climate Crisis Report Asks, What is at Stake? In short, everything." Analysis, major IPCC report, approved by 195 countries, lays bare devastating harm caused by unchecked global heating. And I quote the article. "A livable and sustainable future for all. It is the very last words of the new report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, that spell out what's at stake. In short, it is everything. The damage from global heating is already hitting hard. The comprehensive IPCC assessment, which is based on 34,000 studies, documents widespread and pervasive impacts on people and natural worlds from increasingly frequent and intense heat waves, droughts, wildfires, storms, and floods. Some impacts are now irreversible. Heat is killing more people. Drought is killing more trees, and warming oceans are killing more coral reefs, the nurseries of the oceans. But without action, worse is coming," the report said, "and faster than scientists had thought." The new report analyzes the impact of the climate crisis and how humanity can adapt, in addition to slashing emissions. The good news is that a livable future remains within grasp. Just. But the window of opportunity for action is brief and rapidly closing. The response from UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres was stark. Quote, "Delay is death," unquote. But tackling climate impacts alone will not work. The IPCC sets out in the strongest terms to date that the climate crisis is inseparable from the biodiversity crisis and the poverty and inequality suffered by billions of people. Given this scope, and with a livable future on the line, the assessments could be seen as one of the most important in human history. It was produced by more than 1,000 physical and social scientists and unanimously approved by governments of 195 nations. Quote, "I have seen many scientific reports in my time, but nothing like this," end quote, said Guterres. Lawrence Tubiana, at the European Climate Foundation and one of the architects of the 2015 Climate Agreement, said the report was, in quotes, "brutal, and there could be no more excuses for inaction." Already, 3.5 billion people are highly vulnerable to climate impacts, and half the world's population suffers severe water shortages at some point each year, the report said. 1 in 3 people are exposed to deadly heat stress, and this is projected to increase to 50 to 75% by the end of the century. 500,000 more people are at risk of serious flooding every year, and 1 billion living on coasts will be exposed by 2050, the report said. Rising temperatures and rainfall are increasing the spread of diseases in people, and such as dengue fever, and in crops, livestock, and wildfire. Even if the world keeps heating below 1.6 degrees centigrade by 2100, and we're already at 1.1 degrees centigrade, then 8% of today's farmland will become climatically unsuitable just after the global population has peaked above 9 billion. Severe stunting could affect 1 million children in Africa alone if global heating continues and little adaptation is put in place. If global heating continues and little adaptation is put in place, 183 million more people are projected to go hungry by 2050. The ability to produce food relies on the water, soils, and pollination provided by a healthy natural world. And the report said protection of wild places and wildlife is fundamental to coping with the climate crisis. But animals and plants are being exposed to climatic conditions not experienced for tens of thousands of years. Half of the studied species have already been forced to move, and many face extinction. Maintaining the resilience of nature at a global scale depends on the conservation of 30% to 50% of Earth's land, fresh water, and oceans, the IPCC report said. Today, less than 15% of lands, 21% of fresh water, and 8% of oceans are protected areas. And some regions, like the Amazon, have switched from storing carbon to emitting it. The IPCC report is also crystal clear that adapting to the climate crisis is as much a social problem as a scientific one. The best way to give effective and lasting protection from climate chaos is through action that addresses inequities such as those based on gender, ethnicity, disability, age, location, and income. In quotes, targeting a climate-resilient, sustainable world involves fundamental changes to how society functions, including changes to underlying values, worldviews, ideologies, social structures, political and economic systems, and power relationships, end quote, the report's author said in an accompanying document. Quote, this may feel overwhelming at first, but the world is changing anyway. Climate resilience development offers us ways to drive change to improve well-being for all, end quote. The IPCC report warns that climate losses and damages are strongly concentrated among the poorest vulnerable populations who have done the least to cause the problem. That is a significant phrase, echoing the loss and damage for which low-income nations are demanding compensation from rich nations, and which will be a key issue at the next climate summit in Egypt in November. Madeline Dwafsar, the chair of the Least Developed Countries at the UN Climate Talk, said, quote, I read this report with a great deal of fear and sadness, but not surprise. It's very clear to us that no amount of adaptation can compensate for failing to limit warming to 1.5 degrees centigrade, end quote. However, the regional analysis in the IPCC report demonstrates that the climate crisis affects everyone. In North America, it warns of increasing deaths and physical and mental illness due to greater extreme weather, from storms to wildfires. In Europe, substantive agricultural production losses are projected for most areas over the 21st century. Australia faces increases in heat-related mortality and morbidity for people and wildlife, while destruction lies in wait for small island settlements. In Central and South America, severe health effects due to increasing epidemics are anticipated, particularly from diseases spread by insects and other animals. Among the most populous continents, one of Asia's greatest risks is flooding, and Africa is haunted by hunger as climate impacts hit farmers. The IPCC message that hope remains is measured. Near-term actions that limit global warming to close to 1.5 degrees centigrade would substantially reduce projected losses and damages related to climate change in human systems and ecosystems, but cannot eliminate them all. Some low-lying areas appear doomed already. The report also noted that losses and damages escalate with every increment of global warming, meaning every action to cut emissions or adapt matters. Adaptation is heavily underfunded, the IPCC said, but investment now is far cheaper than acting later. Among the adaptation measures the IPCC cites are restoring wetlands to protect against flooding, greening the world's fast-growing cities to cool them, and using trees to shade crops and livestock. The IPCC scientist said the end of the century is less than a lifetime away, with a child born today being 78 years old in 2100. Actions taken now will have a profound effect on the quality of our children's lives. The future is in the decisions we make today, said Christiana Figueres, former UN climate chief and now at the Global Optimism Group. We can prevent and protect ourselves from extreme weather, famines, health problems, and more by cutting emissions and investing in adaptation strategies. The science and the solutions are clear. It's up to us how we shape the future. And that was, again, an article from The Guardian describing the contents of the major Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report that has talked about some of the devastating harm that is coming our way if we do not take dramatic action on global warming. It's important to keep in mind that a report like this, that took many years to create, worked on by thousands of scientists from countries across the globe, and based upon tens of thousands of studies, is often dismissed on media outlets that have a proven record of selling misinformation on issues ranging from climate change to election fraud and much more. And this dismissal is often done by people who aren't even experts. And yet, those non-expert opinions carry weight, despite the fact that they're clueless compared to what these scientists have put together. And that's because people who listen to media sources who they identify as part of their team want to accept what's said and will likely never even hear what the true scientists, the best experts on our planet, are saying. And there are certainly parallels between what's happening here and what's happening in Russia. Russia is able to maintain the support of so many of its people, considering what they're doing, by keeping them from knowing what's going on. They've shut down media outlets, internet, any way that their people can get the truth. And by doing so, they assure that they're not going to have a massive uprising against their insane actions in Ukraine. It's an effective measure. And in Russia, they're able to do it more completely because they have a tight grasp on everything that reaches the people. There are still people who are able to access the internet, but not the overwhelming majority of Russians. Here in the United States, the misinformation we get is voluminous. However, fortunately, we're able to check it against scientific sources and against courts and against official records and against statistics. So at least if you really are searching for the truth, you can find it. But even with such a tight control of information in Russia, they are having troubles with thousands upon thousands of people taking a risk of going to jail for 15 years to protest what they're doing in Ukraine. It's terrible that most Russians don't even know that there's a war. They think it's a peacekeeping mission. And it's also terrible that Putin is using a page out of Trump's manual in calling actual information false news. So when people hear it, he labels it as false news. And that's what you can go to jail for spreading, that false news that is actually the truth. This is Bob DiBenedetto on the Healthy Planet radio program on WUSB 90.1 FM Stony Brook. We're discussing the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's recent 2022 assessment report and discussing some of the similarities between some of the misinformation or disinformation in Russia and some of the disinformation we get here, as well as potential solutions that we can all bring to the table to help Ukraine. And now we're going to switch gears and listen to the press conference by the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change discussing the findings from their 2022 climate change report on impacts, adaptation, and vulnerability. And it starts out with a short statement by Antonio Guterres, who is the Secretary General of the United Nations. And after his statement, you'll hear from scientists from across the world who have put a lot of time and effort into this report, highlighting various aspects of it. The language that you hear can be alarming, but it is based upon the best scientific information that the world has. And it's also being communicated by scientists who are doing their best to translate the science into accurate words that we can all understand, without adding or taking away from exactly what they found. Here's Antonio Guterres.
Dear representatives of the media, I've seen many scientific reports in my time, but nothing like this. Today's IPCC report is an atlas of human suffering and a damning indictment of failed climate leadership. With fact upon fact, this report reveals how people on the planet are getting clobbered by climate change. Nearly half of humanity is living in the danger zone now. Many ecosystems are at the point of no return now. Unchecked carbon pollution is forcing the world's most vulnerable on a frog march to destruction now. The facts are undeniable. This abdication of leadership is criminal. The world's biggest polluters are guilty of arson on our only home. It is essentially to meet the goal of limiting global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees. And science tells us that will require the world to cut emissions by 45% by 2030 and achieve net zero emissions of greenhouse gases by 2050. But according to current commitments, global emissions are set to increase almost 14% over the current decade. That spells catastrophe. It will destroy any chance of keeping 1.5 alive. Today's report underscores two core truths. First, coal and other fossil fuels are choking humanity. All G20 governments have agreed to stop funding coal abroad. They must now urgently do the same at home and dismantle their coal fleets. Those in the private sector still financing coal must be held to account. Oil and gas giants and their underwriters are also on notice. You cannot claim to be green while your plans and projects undermine the 2050 net zero target and ignore the major emission cuts that must occur this decade. People see through the smoke screen. OECD countries must phase out coal by 2030 and all others by 2040. The present global energy mix is broken. As current events make all too clear, our continued reliance on fossil fuels makes the global economy and energy security vulnerable to geopolitical shocks and crises. Instead of slowing down the decarbonization of the global economy, now is the time to accelerate the energy transition to a renewable energy future. Fossil fuels are a dead end for our planet, for humanity, and yes, for economies. A prompt, well-managed transition to renewables is the only pathway to energy security, universal access, and the green jobs our world needs. I'm calling for developed countries, multilateral development banks, private financiers, and others to form coalitions to help major emerging economies end the use of coal. These targeted mechanisms of support would be over and above existing sustainable development needs. The second core finding from this report is slightly better news. Investments in adaptation work. Adaptation saves lives. As climate impacts worsen, and they will, scaling up investments will be essential for survival. Adaptation and mitigation must be pursued with equal force and urgency. That is why I've been pushing to get the 50% of all climate finance for adaptation. The Glasgow commitment on adaptation funding is not enough to meet the challenges faced by nations on the front lines of the climate crisis. I'm also pressing to remove the obstacles that prevent small island states and least developed countries from getting the finance they desperately need to save lives and livelihoods. We need new eligibility systems to deal with this new reality. Delay means death. I take inspiration from all those on the front lines of the climate battle fighting back with solutions. All development banks, multilateral, regional, national, know what needs to be done. Work with governments to design pipelines of bankable adaptation projects and help them find the funding, public and private. And every country must honor the Glasgow Pledge to strengthen national climate plans every year until they are aligned with 1.5 degrees Celsius. The G20 must lead the way, or humanity will pay an even more tragic price. I know people everywhere are anxious and angry. I am too. Now is the time to turn rage into action. Every fraction of the degree matters. Every voice can make a difference, and every second counts. Thank you.
Following Secretary General's message, I now invite the chair of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, Dr. Hua Sung Lee, to take the floor.
Thank you very much. Distinguished representatives of the media, WMO Secretary General Petteri, UNEP Executive Director Anderson, We have just heard a powerful message from the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. The findings of the IPCC report we are releasing today are clear. The stakes for our planet have never been higher. Last August, the IPCC's Working Group 1 report showed unequivocally that human activities have warmed the climate at a rate not seen in at least the past 2,000 years. We are on course to reaching global warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius within the next two decades, and temperature will continue to rise unless the world takes much bolder action. The Working Group 2 report we are releasing today provides the latest understanding of what does this warming means for the people, ecosystems, and the planet. The report is a warning about, a dire warning about the consequences of inaction. It shows that climate change is a grave and mounting threat to our well-being and a healthy planet. It also shows that our action today will shape how people are able to adapt to climate change and how nature responds to increasing climate risks. Severe climate change impacts are already happening. Vulnerable people, those marginalized socially and economically, are the most exposed to climate change impacts and have the least resources to adapt. Today, we also deepen our understanding of solutions to climate change and how adaptation can help us lower risks and reduce vulnerability. These solutions open new opportunities for innovation in our societies and economies. Our collective and individual adaptation can be an effective strategy, but there are limits to how much we and other species can adapt. Beyond certain temperatures, adaptation is no longer possible for some species. Our report is a blueprint for our future on this planet. It recognizes the interdependence of climate, ecosystems, and biodiversity and people. Critically, this report highlights the importance of including and using diverse forms of knowledge, such as indigenous and local knowledge. But most importantly, it emphasizes the urgency of immediate and more ambitious action to address climate risks. Half measures are no longer an action. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, for these compelling remarks. I now invite the Secretary General of the World Meteorological Organization, Petteri Tallas, to take the floor.
Today we are releasing the second part of the IPCC Sixth Assessment Report. The report says that climate change induced by us humans has caused widespread negative impacts to nature, people, beyond the natural climate variability. Altogether, 127 risks have been identified, covering very wide range of sectors like health, agriculture, economy, infrastructure, and ecosystems. Our atmosphere today is on steroids, doped with fossil fuels. This is already leading to stronger, longer, and more frequent extreme weather events. Climate change-induced disasters come with high human and economic impacts. More than four in 10 people in the world live in contexts highly vulnerable to climate change. But all countries are affected, as we have seen in Germany, United States, and Canada last year. It is essential to raise the ambition level of climate mitigation. That would also have a positive impact on air quality and is vital to tackle the looming water crisis and sea level rise. Climate mitigation offers also great business opportunities in many sectors like energy, transport, industry, and nutrition. Besides mitigation, it is more and more critical to pay attention to adaptation, since the negative trend in weather extremes will anyhow continue for the coming decades, and sea level rise for centuries due to the record high concentration of carbon dioxide. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Secretary General Tallas, for these important remarks. I now invite Inge Andersen, the Executive Director of UNEP, United Nations Environment Programme, to take the floor.
Thank you so much. And to you, Professor Hosong Lee, to you, Petri, my colleague, of course, to Abdallah Moksit, Secretary of IPCC, and to the co-chairs, Dr. Deborah Roberts and Dr. Hans Otto Portner, and to the amazing and formidable IPCC scientific community and friends, greetings from Nairobi. We are in the midst of United Nations Environment Assembly, which gathers here to look at environmental issues. And this report comes at a time of great turmoil, when we need strong multilateralism to promote peace and healthy environment. And the message this report sends is clear. Climate change isn't lurking around the corner waiting to pounce. It's already upon us, raining down blows on billions of people. We're seeing dangerous disruption across the natural world. Species are migrating in search of more livable conditions. In climate risk hotspots, deaths from floods, droughts, or storms were 15 times higher than those in more resilient countries over the last decade. This is climate injustice, particularly for indigenous people and local communities. And all of this and more at only 1.1 degrees Celsius of global warming. Even if we limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, the blows will come harder and faster. As things stand, we're heading to closer to 3 degrees Celsius. We are in an emergency heading for a disaster. We can't keep taking these hits and treating the wounds. Soon those wounds would be too deep, too catastrophic to heal. We need to soften and slow the blows by cutting greenhouse gas emissions, but we also need to cushion the blows by picking up our efforts to adapt to climate change, which have been too weak for too long. The best way to do this is to let nature do the job it spends millions of years perfecting, absorbing and channeling rainwater and surging waves, maintaining biodiversity and balance in the soils so that diverse plants can grow, providing cooling shade under leafy canopies. We need large-scale ecosystem restoration from ocean to mountaintop, including through agreeing to start negotiations on the Global Plastic Pollution Agreement here in Nairobi at the 5th United Nations Environment Assembly. We need to bring nature into baking hot cities to keep them cool. We need to conserve mangroves, coral reefs, and other nature's defenses. We need to protect and restore wetlands for nature and incorporate wetlands into our cities. Backing nature is the best way to adapt to and to slow climate change while providing jobs and boosting economies. We must start dedicating thought and funding to transformational adaptation programs with nature at their heart. Humanity has spent centuries treating nature like its worst enemy. The truth is that nature can be our savior, but only if we save it first. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Andersen, for these thoughtful remarks. We will now hear the presentation of the report's findings from the co-chairs of the Working Group 2, Dr. Deborah Roberts and Dr. Hans Otto Portner.
Thank you, Andre. It's indeed a great pleasure to welcome the global community to the start of a really important global conversation where I and my fellow co-chair will present the outcomes of 5 years of hard work by the global scientific community. So welcome everyone around the world. We are very proud to present this latest report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which focuses on climate change impacts, adaptation, and vulnerability. 270 authors from 67 countries have worked tirelessly to produce this report. Over the last 5 years, they have assessed 34,000 scientific papers to prepare their findings. During the review process, they considered each one of 62,418 comments from experts and governments, which have helped make the report as comprehensive and clear as possible. We would like to thank everyone who has contributed to this process. Let us now share some of the key findings which reflect our growing scientific knowledge and provide the best understanding yet of climate change impacts, risks, options to adapt, and the limits we face. Perhaps this statement best summarizes our findings. The scientific evidence is unequivocal. Climate change is a threat to human well-being and the health of the planet. Any further delay in concerted global action will miss the brief and rapidly closing window to secure a livable future. This report offers solutions to the world. And in the next 20 minutes, we will explore these with you. But let's start with the impacts.
Global warming of 1.1 degrees Celsius has caused dangerous and widespread disruption in nature. The increased frequency, intensity, and duration of extreme events on land and in the ocean is driving mass mortalities, for example, in trees, as we show here in this drought-stressed forest in California, USA. And climate change is affecting the lives and livelihoods of billions of people. The impacts from human-induced intensification of tropical cyclones, sea level rise, and heavy rainfall have resulted in increased losses and damages. Impacts are magnified in cities, where more than half the world's population lives. Heat waves amplify urban heat islands and air pollution to affect people's health. Critical infrastructure, such as transport, water, sanitation, and energy systems, have been compromised by extreme events.
When multiple extreme events happen at the same time, they compound the overall risk and are more difficult to manage. What we see here is an example of how heat and drought combine to cause reduction in crop yields, made worse by reduced productivity because of heat stress amongst farm workers. Reduced yields lead to reductions in household incomes, increased food prices, locally and potentially globally. Climate risks do not respect national boundaries, and weather-related extremes are creating shocks to global trade. In the previous slide, we illustrated the powerful impacts of climate change on nature and people's lives. In this assessment, it is based on a new understanding of these interconnections. We can no longer think in silos, but have to look across climate, biodiversity, and human society and well-being if we want to tackle the many global challenges we face today. And talking of other challenges, climate change combines with unsustainable use of natural resources, habitat destruction, deforestation, and growing urbanization, as well as inequity and marginalization. These trends not only present threats to ecosystems and the people who rely on them, but also reduce the capacities of nature, communities, and individuals to adapt to climate change. 3.3 to 3.6 billion people live in global hotspots of high vulnerability to climate change. These are across large parts of Africa, as well as South Asia, Central and South America, small islands, and the Arctic. In these global hotspots, overlapping challenges include limited access to water, sanitation, and health services, high levels of climate-sensitive livelihoods, such as smallholder farmers and fishing communities, all increase vulnerability, high levels of poverty, weak leadership, lack of funding, lack of accountability, and trust in government also play a part.
That was the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change at a press conference talking about their Climate Change 2022 impacts, adaptation, and vulnerability. So we heard a lot of information about what could happen and what is likely to happen. And much of it is tragedies beyond what we can imagine, with billions of people being potential climate refugees, billions of people potentially being displaced by rising sea levels, wildfires, droughts, change in food patterns, and the list goes on. We talked about Vladimir Putin being potentially unstable, something being not right. Or is he just of the Dr. Evil persuasion? We have to ask the same question about our current politicians. the ones who have access to the same information you've been listening to, but who have refused to take any action or to inform their constituencies about the warnings of the best minds on our planet. And they're not doing that for the good of humankind. They're doing it out of self-interest and catering to a base that is likely unmotivated to hear the other side, because they've been listening to and believing in the people who they think are on their side for so long that there's no room for the truth if it happens to contradict the narrative that they're so used to hearing. Our elected officials are only in office because we put them there. Consider how you vote next time. And if you have the chance to interact with your elected official, ask them why they hold the stance they do. Ask them if they know about the science that's been worked on for decades upon decades. The response you get will probably sound very good to a 1950s person, where oil and gas are as American as apple pie. So there have been a lot of energy articles around lately, and I'll close by reading to you excerpts of an article about another study by Mark Jacobson. He's been doing and releasing studies on clean energy, the possibility of moving entirely to clean energy, the cost of doing so, the job creation possibilities of doing so. And this article is about his newest study that shines more light on the fact that we can not only do all of those things, create clean energy in a hurry, and create a lot of jobs, but he says in doing so, we will also make our grid a lot more stable. The article is entitled Renewable Energy, Zero Blackouts, Millions of New Jobs by Steve Hanley, posted on cleantechnica.com. This was published February 21st of 2022. Mark Z. Jacobson is a professor of civil and environmental engineering at Stanford University and director of its Atmosphere Energy Program. He's also a frequent contributor to Clean Technica. He and his team have published several research papers that describe how the transition to renewable energy can provide reliable electricity at lower cost while creating new jobs. That's the technical and economic side of his analysis. The other component involves the social benefits that will flow from using clean, renewable energy, namely, healthier Americans who live longer. Jacobson, together with researchers Anna Katharina von Crowland, Stephen Coughlin, Francis Palmer, and Miles Smith, has recently published an updated study which builds on prior research to show switching to 100% renewable energy, what Jacobson describes as wind, water, and solar, would virtually eliminate the electrical grid blackouts that have plagued many areas of the country in recent years, particularly in California and Texas. Quote, technically and economically, we have 95% of the technologies we need to transition everything today, Jacobson tells the Washington Post. What is wind, water, solar? As a scientist, Jacobson and his colleagues are careful to define their terms. Here's the introduction to this latest study by Jacobson. We define clean, renewable energy as energy that emits zero health and climate-affecting air pollutants when consumed and has a source that continuously replenishes the energy. We call energy sources that meet these criteria wind, water, solar sources. The only hydrogen considered is green hydrogen made from WWS energy. The Jacobson team found that energy demand actually decreased significantly by shifting to renewable resources. Why is that? Electric car owners know why. A gasoline engine is only about 30% efficient. That is, more than two-thirds of the energy contained in a gallon of gasoline does nothing to move your car forward and is wasted. It's like trying to air condition your home while leaving all the windows and doors open. You could do it, but why? The only reason people tolerate conventional cars is because government policies keep the price of gasoline unrealistically low. By contrast, more than 80% of the energy stored as electricity in the battery of an electric car is converted into forward motion. So to repeat that, only 30% of the energy that you get from gasoline gets translated into moving your car, whereas 80% of the energy stored as energy in a battery of an electric car is converted into forward motion. Because devices powered by electricity are so much more efficient than their fossil fueled equivalents, the researchers found transitioning to those electric and hydrogen fuel cell vehicles, heat pumps, induction cooktops, arc furnaces, resistance furnaces, lawnmowers, leaf blowers, chainsaws, and more, would lower the demands for primary energy in the entire United States by around 57%. Per capita household energy costs would also be about 63% less than in a business as usual scenario. Co-author of the study, Anna Katharina von Krauwelens, said, "Everything that we currently do using fossil fuels would be done using technology that is run through electricity. The amount of energy that's needed to perform activities basically to turn on the light or fuel industrial processes, that would actually be decreased if you use more efficient energy supply." In addition to improving grid stability, the study found operating a clean, renewable grid could create almost 5 million long-term, full-time jobs, not only in construction and manufacturing, but also in ancillary businesses that support those activities. The systems would also produce cleaner air, which could reduce air pollution-related deaths by 53,000 people per year and reduce pollution-related illnesses for millions of people in 2050. Robert Harworth, a professor at Cornell University who was not involved in the research, said this is an incredibly important study. "The fossil fuel industries continue to argue that renewables are a dangerous experiment, and that grid stability and reliability will continue to depend at least in part on fossil fuels. Here, Jacobson in this new study and his colleagues clearly show that this is not the case at all." Andrew Dressler, a professor of atmospheric sciences at Texas A&M University, who was not involved in the study, agrees. He says the findings of this study are not controversial at all. Obviously, it will work just because there's so much renewable energy available on the planet. Just from a physics standpoint, there's no fundamental constraint here. The constraint is political. You've got to get people to get together and decide to do this. And that's really what's difficult. And of course, he's talking about the fact that there's no limit to the amount of wind and solar and wave energy. Mark Jacobson, author of the study, added, "We do need a really rapid transition by 80% of clean energy by 2030, and 100% as soon as possible after that. It really requires a large-scale effort among lots of people to solve this problem. It's not one scientific study that's going to solve the problem." And the article goes on to say that thanks to those who take money from the fossil fuel industry, like Joe Manchin, Americans will be denied the benefits of a fully functioning renewable energy system until all the campaign contributions from oil and gas companies dry up. And that's unfortunate. And on that note, this is Bob DiBenedetto with the Healthy Planet Radio Show. I'll be with you again next time on Friday, April 8th at 6 p.m., and every month thereafter at 6 p.m. on the first two Fridays of the month. When I'm not here, be sure to listen to Natural Alternatives and the Healthy Planet shows every week at this time, with great hosts sharing cutting-edge information on health, our environment, and so much more. That's every week, Fridays at 6 p.m. For more info on Healthy Planet and our radio shows, or if you're interested in having me do a virtual presentation to your school or group, visit our website at www.healthyplanetusa.org. Or email us to join our mailing list at info@healthyplanetusa.org. Also, like our Facebook page, which is @HealthyPlanetUSA. Until next time, stay strong, relax, make your voice heard in this world by continuing to speak up for what's right. Be kind to those around you, including our amazing four or multi-legged friends. Remember to enjoy each moment of existence on this beautiful planet, and do what you can as part of the global community to stop funding fossil fuels, and therefore supporting everything that fossil fuel purchases support. Good night.
Our climate is changing. Making a few changes to your driving habits can cut tailpipe emissions and improve fuel efficiency. Drive smart. Go easy on the brakes and gas pedal. Get regular tune-ups by following your vehicle's maintenance schedule. Check your tire pressure. Combine as many activities and errands into one trip as possible reduce your carbon impact to the environment. Act now on climate change.
A stay in the hospital for people of all ages can be a stressful and challenging experience. But every day, teams of volunteers in UCLA's People Animal Connection, or PAC, make the lives of patients and their families better.
You see the patients get happier and more relaxed. They kind of forget that they're in a hospital bed.
The visits are provided to hospitalized patients without cost. Learn how you can get involved at uclahealth.org/PAC.